I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. Like the rum that fills their oak barrels, the battle between liquor giants Bacardi and Pernod Ricard has aged for years. The bitter dispute over the rightful owner of the Havana Club trademark has spanned generations. Yet for the families that produce this traditional Cuban rum and the loyal fans who drink it, this war is about more than just a trademark. It's a fight grounded in Cuban identity, culture, and politics. And it's far from over. But before we can ask the real Havana Club to stand up, we've got to wade through a murky pool of legal gray areas, government alliances, and fickle geopolitical policies. Guiding us through all this is our guest today, Lillian Guerra, a Cuban-American author, historian, and professor at the University of Florida, and the director of their Cuba program. We'll be talking about where the spirits battle stands from a Cuban perspective, exploring the island's economics, and the future of Havana Club on the American stage. All that's coming up next. Lillian Guerra, welcome to Business Wars.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, this is a deeply personal rivalry that seems like it's never going to end. What's the current situation between Bacardi and Pernod Ricard?
Well, I don't know that it has changed in any way. The Cuban government is very committed to working with its partners at Pernod Ricard. And as far as I know, the Biden administration has not taken any steps to back the lawsuit that Bacardi has filed. So we're still at a standstill there.
Yeah, I was curious about how much the Cuban people themselves know about this rivalry. Do you have a sense that everyday Cubans, persons on the street, are aware of this battle?
I'm certain that they are completely unaware. I do think they have very strong opinions about rum, and in particular Havana Club, as they have experienced it on the island. But that they know anything about this really would be impossible. The Cuban government has very little transparency with regard to its own budget and its own income or the state's expenditures. So, you know, something like this will not make headlines unless it's politically expedient. So if they are to win their battle, then I assume, you know, it'll be all splashed all over the national newspaper. But until then, you know, nothing.
Well, for our listeners and perhaps others who are joining us fresh, in one corner you have Pernod claiming Havana Club must be made in Cuba. Then in the other corner there's Bacardi, who says they can make it in Puerto Rico since they have the recipe, history, and Cuban family identity on their side. We're talking about the founders in this case. In your mind, who has the real stuff?
You know, I think it's very interesting to say that my knowledge of Cuban rum and where Bacardi produced it comes from the island. And in Cuba, when Havana Club started becoming, you know, a regular item on display in dollar stores, stores that sold in dollars to foreigners and in hotels, Cubans were convinced that it was not being made properly because they weren't using the old barrels that are still out in Oriente, you know, which is the far eastern province, and they were using metal barrels and distillery, you know, that was relatively recently acquired and too modern, so that there was no way that what was being replicated there in Cuba would resemble, you know, the real stuff. So that argument is not on the table here between these two companies. They are both focusing, well, they've got different points of view, but one is focusing on the recipe and the other is focusing on the ingredients and the location. And neither company are talking about how the rum is actually aged and what kind of equipment is being used. My sense is that the really old barrels that are in the oldest distilleries that were used by the Bacardi family have nothing to do with the creation of this Havana Club. And those are being used for another government label that is mostly only available on the island and is extremely popular because it is so good. And that label is Santiago de Cuba. So you have to buy it again for hard currency in dollar stores or in hotels and tourist facilities. but it is mostly consumed locally, and it is widely enjoyed. I mean, it's also my favorite rum of all of those available.
Ooh, well, you anticipated my next question, but I want to clarify something here. Are you suggesting that the real stuff is defined by the barrels that they're aged in?
Well, Cubans would say that is true. That, you know, they, first of all, the barrels that we're talking about that the Bacardi family used in the 19th century and through most of the 20th century were made out of Cuban mahogany. And that has a particular density to it. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the hardest woods in the world. So the trees that were used to build these or to construct these barrels, you know, were 300-year-old trees, 200-year-old trees, enormous. And they're still available. You can still see them in certain pockets of forest. Wow. In both Santa Clara and in Oriente in the mountains. Cubans have very strong connections. Island Cubans have very strong connections to these kinds of icons of their identity. The mahogany that these barrels are made out of seems to have a particular, it has cachet, we can say.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it's clear why this is such a fight, certainly from the Cuban side, because as we were saying earlier, this is a big part of Cuban history, Cuban identity. What is real? What is legitimate? I mean, all of these questions are coming into play. What does it mean to be Cuban in a sense? But I want to get back to something you were saying to your palate. You prefer the stuff made in Cuba. Let's talk about taste. The Pernod Ricard Havana Club's pretty hard to find in the U.S. because of the embargo. And I would imagine you have been able to try both versions.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the distinctions as you sense them.
Well, first of all, there is this silver dry, which is how they label it, this white stuff that no Cuban in his right mind would drink. It is used for cocktails in Cuba. Cubans of an older generation claim that you would never have used an unaged kind of raw sugarcane rum to make cocktails, that you would have used at least a three-year-old rum. But then you get these older, you know, the ones that are labeled 5 years, etc. What they all have in common is that they're dry. They have a very dry flavor to them. The one that is the least dry is this the sort of randomly labeled Añejo Havana Club. The drier you get, the shorter the finish. And Cubans like the taste to be syrupy almost, to be real strong and intense and have a long finish. So I am a big believer in that too. I think that some of the best Bacardi rums that I have tried, I've tried in Puerto Rico at their distillery. They have a kind of solera quality to them.
What is it? You say solera quality?
Solera, which is, it's sort of the blending of very young rums with older rums that then produce a kind of a syrupy, thicker taste to the rum. Mm-hmm. And those are very, very popular today in the United States.
Well, of course, in the States, we can only get Bacardi's Havana Club, but with Pernod Ricard actively working to get their version into the U.S. market, both brands clearly have a vested interest in appealing to the American palate, I suppose, if there is a way to define such a thing. But what are Pernod and Bacardi doing to try to win over the hearts and minds of U.S. consumers as you see it?
Well, they have launched quite a campaign to deepen the historical roots of this recipe. At their distillery in Puerto Rico, they have a room that actually shows old rum barrels. And if you ask them, the tour guide, they will actually have to admit to you that there is really nothing old about them, nor are they from Cuba. But the family that is the author of the recipe has now been sort of foregrounded in the company's history. And that's significant because really until this lawsuit was issued or took place, the Bacardis were very happy, or the Bacardis, as we correctly pronounce it, were very happy to sort of, take the credit for everything. And you would never have heard about this this recipe holder or recipe holding family were not for the desire to authenticate the Cubanness. Now, I think in the end, the campaign isn't really working. For a really long time, until the lawsuit, The Bacardis were, you know, ensconced in Miami,
right.
And they were very upset about anything that would remind the consumer of communism or of the triumph of the revolution, as Fidel would have called it. So they really diminished that. They kind of wanted to project an idea of sort of abstract Latinidad or abstract Caribbean identity. And I think that most Americans came to drink Bacardi rum in the 80s and the early 90s and really bought into that idea. So now for them to reverse course and say, no, we're really Cuban, it looks sort of not that convincing and a little weird.
And Cuba, of course, has been making a lot of big headlines of late, and I want to dig into that just a little bit more as Business Wars continues. Our guest, Lillian Guerra, a Cuban-American scholar and author at the University of Florida. There's more Business Wars coming up. Welcome back to Business Wars. Our guest today is Lillian Guerra. She is a Cuban-American scholar and author at the University of Florida. I mentioned before the break that Cuba's made headlines recently for the largest wave of protests against the government since 1994 or so. But you mentioned earlier that Cubans on the island, they tend to have conversations about politics, talk openly, only behind closed doors. So I guess I'm wondering why people are speaking out now, as you see it.
Well, yes, they had conversations about politics behind closed doors, but really from 1991 till very recently, about 2014, 2015, Cubans were having very, very critical conversations about the government in public fora, just not in organized fashion. Mm. So that means, you know, in the hallways of the library, you know, not in the classroom, in your workplace, when you're on your smoke break or when you're walking around, you know, outside to stretch your legs or something. That's where people were having a lot of conversations constantly. I mean, they were able to because the Cuban state for a very long time was unable to enforce, you know, what had been longstanding legal restrictions on people's ability to express themselves, and then more importantly, on a kind of institutionalized popular culture of surveillance. So we're talking about 1991 to 2021, we're thinking about 30 years there, mm-hmm. and for about 20, you know, Cubans really got a taste of freedom. They felt they had the right to criticize socialism. They felt they had the right to criticize socialist policies. They felt they had the right to make jokes about leaders because they got away with it. They got away with it because they were not in organized demonstrations or unorganized demonstrations. They were doing it, you know, in just their everyday life. About 2014, 2015, negotiations with the Obama administration that were intended to normalize relations with Cuba included the demand on the part of the U.S. government that there be Wi-Fi access, public Wi-Fi in plazas and in open areas of Cuba. And so starting in 2015, 2016, this has happened.
Oh, that is fascinating.
The social media that has exploded in Cuba have been Facebook and WhatsApp. And those two are possible connectors because they're encrypted. And so the Cuban government can't hack into what you're saying. This is what's enabled people to be inspired, because I don't know that there is an organization at all. These protests are not organized. What did happen on Sunday is they started in one location, and as soon as the videos of the repression hit the social media networks, then you got thousands of people across the island in towns and cities everywhere protesting.
Opposition to Cuba's communist economy isn't anything new. Much of that shows up in the Havana Club debate, as we've been discussing. The economic upheaval that followed the revolution in 59 clearly rocked the island's industry, and the Bacardis weren't the only ones who lost their company. What was it like for the other businesses that were nationalized?
Well, you know, one of the great tragic stories here of the nationalization of the businesses is that those who took over, that means the government or the supporters of the government who took over, many of them were simply completely unqualified other than because of their loyalty to the government. So loyalty trumped expertise. And for the first 10 years after 1915, or really after 1960, which is when the big nationalizations happened, for the first 10 years after that, Cubans found that a lot of the factories that had been nationalized just simply ceased to function. So you have a situation whereby the 1970s, the crisis was so great. It was an economic crisis generated largely by mismanagement of government resources and these companies, that the Soviets were invited to step in. And Cuba did not become, in fact, until 1972, when it forged this deal, a part of CARICOM, which was the, effectively the Soviet bloc, the trading bloc.
Right.
In the 70s, you had for the first time, positive rates of growth. I mean, they were negative in the 60s. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, the story continues because effectively by the end of the 80s, when the Soviets are gone, and the subsidies are gone, all of that collapsed. And today it's always very painful to see Cubans or their relatives return to what were their stores or their small businesses, and realize, what shape and shambles they have been in, not just for, 30 years, but perhaps for longer than that.
I think in a sense, you sort of anticipated what I was going to next ask, and that is, how do you sense the economy is holding up in Cuba today?
Right now, it's a complete disaster. I mean, they have had zero tourism since the COVID epidemic began.
Right.
They've responded very poorly. The government has responded very poorly to that by deciding that, no, it's not going to negotiate with anybody to get vaccines. They'll just manufacture their own. They started trying to do 5 different vaccines. They supposedly have 2 now, and about 26% of the population only is vaccinated. Cuba has been on complete lockdown, and tourism was the number one generator of income, both for the state and for all of the local service providers and people who were small entrepreneurs. So that has, to say that, basically that's gone means that their economy is at a standstill. Inflation's running about 500%. The government has no ability to get credit abroad because, in part because of the embargo and in part because of its very poor credit history. And the economy is non-existent.
Well, focusing on that economic side of it, this might be a good place for us to reintroduce the Havana Club debate because, of course, foreign investors like Pernod, at least in theory, could perhaps help with the tough economic situation there. And, if you go back, allowing foreign investors into Cuba in the first place was very off-brand for Castro. If you look at the beginnings of that Pernod-Ricard relationship, this is a partnership that has stuck for nearly 30 years, a real odd couple sort of deal. What is that relationship like now that Miguel Díaz-Canel is the sitting president of Cuba?
Yeah, it's very thorny. The Cuban government has, in many respects, shifted the burden of, or maybe the privilege is a better word, of working with the foreign investors to the Ministry of the Armed Forces, because they are the guys with the weapons, and they are the guys who exercise the greatest power under Raul Castro, whose main job during the Fidel years was to be head of the armed forces. Mm-hmm. So generals are the CEOs of Cuba, and they work, hand in hand with their equivalents, the chief financial officers as well, are the top brass in the military. Mm-hmm. So they operate under a giant umbrella corporation called GESA that controls 82% of the economy right now. So foreign investors have always, when they have worked with the Cuban government, they have had to make enormous compromises, most of which never make the news. We don't hear about them. These locations, the joint ventures with the Cuban government, they, in the landscape of Cuba, are filled with tensions. Always.
As we've been talking about that relationship between Pernod Ricard and Cuba and the Cuban government, at the same time, Bacardi became a force to be reckoned with in the U.S., and I'm talking about not so much the family as the brand, right? So refresh us a little bit on how deep that relationship runs.
I think they have very intelligently not taken positions that they might have favored, at least publicly, with respect to the U.S. embargo, because they are very aware the Bacardi family, along with other big Cuban families, are very aware of the fact that the Cuban exile community has been outraged to know in different moments when it's been possible that perhaps there should be a loosening of the embargo. So that has really dampened the possibilities that, at least openly, these companies would seek or pressure the U.S. Government to change its policies towards Cuba.
Which brings us, in a sense, to the here and now when we're talking about the debate over Havana Club and that larger geopolitical context, right? I mean, the Cuban government has been blaming vaccine and food shortages on the U.S. embargo. It's not clear that we are currently in anything like the sort of relationship that President Obama tried to engender with the Cuban government back when back during his tenure. How do you see things now and moving forward under President Biden? And does it come down to that embargo question?
Well, there are a number of problems with the embargo question in the sense that Biden no longer, no president can really just by decree or fiat,
unilaterally.
Yeah, get rid of it. It, you know, after President Clinton in 1996 allowed for the Helms-Burton Act to be signed, what we got was an embargo that can only be lifted if the U.S. Congress lifts it. So that means the president can't do that kind of thing. What he can do, however, is, you know, allow for certain things to happen, like person-to-person exchanges, open up and put no restrictions on the amount of money that an American can send a Cuban on the island. For a time, from 2014 to 2016, you had that exact thing happening. These kinds of possibilities stand there as real options for Biden.
I want to bring this full circle because, you know, our conversation, this has been really enlightening, certainly to me. It all started over a bottle of rum. And I'm curious, were Congress to take steps to lift the embargo, what do you see that meaning for the future of Havana Club?
Well, I think it's going to have some stiff competition. I think that, you know, it has a certain appeal because it's exotic. You know, that appeal was even more exotic back in the 90s, you know, or in the early 2000s. And I know that that's somewhat diminished. But so now the question would be, like, what does it taste like? You know,
right,
you know,
sure,
is it really
sure.
that good? Yeah. And that's a very interesting question. You know, I think it has some competitors in the U.S. market that might beat it out pretty quickly. And so, you know, the taste will have to be the main concern or the main factor in terms of determining its success, precisely because I don't imagine that very easily Pernod is going to figure out how to market this. You know,
yeah.
You know what I mean? If it is a state company, you know, in some way, you know, it's arriving in the United States, then a lot of people would boycott it simply because it's a state company. Doesn't matter if there's a French label or a name slapped on it.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what develops in the next few years. Lillian Guerra is a professor of history at the University of Florida and an acclaimed Cuban-American scholar. Her latest book came out in 2018, is Heroes, Martyrs, and Political Messiahs in Revolutionary Cuba, published by Yale. And she's got a new book coming out soon. Professor, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on Business Wars.
Thank you.
On our next episode, American gangsters travel to the Nevada desert to make their dreams come true and change the landscape of an entire region as Las Vegas is born. From Wondery, this is Episode 7 of Bacardi vs. Pernod Ricard for Business Wars. I'm your host, David Brown. Kelly Kyle produced this episode. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Edited and produced by Emily Frost. Sound designed by Kyle Randall. Kate Young is our associate producer. Dave Schilling is our producer. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.